Let's get into the Word. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 3 this evening. Daniel 3. And I'm going to open again with a passage that we looked at on Sunday morning. Hold your finger in Daniel 3 and turn over to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus 20. I don't think it's an accident that on Sunday morning and on Wednesday evening we are able to open the Bible study with the same passage, although I didn't plan it this way. I don't usually plan messages that way. The Lord apparently did this particular little bit of planning. Because Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, and I would like to read just the first five verses. A sobering reminder, and then as we look into Daniel 3, you'll see how this plays out in the lives of three men who are very famous, and a very, very famous account. But the background for what these men do in defying the most powerful man on earth and in remaining loyal to God, the background of it is understanding the difference between faith and idolatry and realizing that God is not a pluralist in this sense. He does not allow his people to worship him by the use of idols, and he does not allow his people to worship any other god in any way. So have a look at Exodus 20, the Lord speaking to Israel at Mount Sinai, their first introduction to him as a nation, really. This was how he introduced himself to them. And he said, chapter 20 of Exodus, verse 1, then God spoke all these, notice that, he said it audibly to them, spoke all these words to them, verse 2, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods except for me or before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them nor serve them, because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. He introduces himself by saying, I am the only God that there is. And if you worship another god, that is idolatry. He's very, very strong on the loyalty issue. And he's very clear on what constitutes idolatry, really, in its crass sense, in its most basic sense. And that is declaring your loyalty, your ultimate loyalty, worshiping. Because that's how you worship, really, is by living your loyalty out to some other god. And he says, if you know me, you don't do that. You belong to me. A brief explanation of verses, well, mostly verse 5, because it troubles people. I mentioned it on Sunday morning, and I'll mention it again now. What does he mean when he says, I visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation? He means that people will teach their children their priorities, whether they mean to or not. And if you teach your children to not love God and to not respect him, or you teach them to be idolaters, they will be enemies of God from generation to generation. And they will have a relationship in which they hate him and he hates them. And you don't want that. Faith is taught from generation to generation, but so is idolatry. And he warns the people, once you know me, you teach to the best of your ability every generation. Now, go to Daniel 3. These young men, known by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were friends of Daniel's. They were all taken when they were teenagers. They were stolen, really, at gunpoint from their hometown, which was Jerusalem. They had been raised to trust Yahweh. And you can imagine, as Nebuchadnezzar had come in the first of the three great deportations, this discipline God was bringing against Israel, Nebuchadnezzar, the pagan king, came and was given authority over Jerusalem. You can imagine the parents of these young men finding out that they were never going to see him again at this rather tender age. I know that a 15 or 16-year-old boy doesn't think he's tender. He thinks he's bulletproof, but adults know. And they would have seen these young men and would have realized, I'm never going to see him again. He's going to go to Babylon, and who knows what will happen to him there. And the last words their parents or their mentors would have said to them would be something along the lines of, you have to keep walking with God. And these young men had the Ten Commandments in their hearts, and they understood what it meant to be loyal to Yahweh, even in another country. Even in a culture that taught henotheism, which is the idea that different countries have different gods, and you should worship the god of the country you're in. That's henotheism. These young men were taught, no, there's one God, and wherever you are, you worship only him. And if you're in covenant with him, if you are in covenant with him, you keep the covenant. And word number one of the covenant, words one and two, commandments one and two, you have no other gods, and you never use physical idolatry to worship any other god or me, he says. You simply don't. You don't make any carvings of me, and any carving you have had better not be an idol that you pray to, fall down before, or worship. Now, these young men knew this, and they sustained this integrity of their faith all through their time as they served in Babylon. And that's why they become so famous. That's why this is one of the most exciting and famous stories in the Bible. It is the story of the fiery furnace. But don't get lost in the drama of it. I want you to see the terror of it. I want you to realize what these men would have felt. We don't know what age they were when this took place. They may have been just in their mid-20s. They may have also been in their late 30s, because it depends on when the event takes place, and scholars really aren't quite sure. It is tied to the previous dream in which Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in which he saw a statue, and the head of the statue was gold, and then Daniel interpreted it, and Daniel told him, that's you, you're the king of the first kingdom in this line. And it could be that Nebuchadnezzar, shortly thereafter, decided, if the head is gold, why not make a great big statue that's all gold, and I'll just take all the glory. Maybe it's something like that. Or it could have been several years later, in which Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the glory of God. It's an interesting thing, because at the end of chapter 2, if you'll remember, he was so impressed with Daniel's God after hearing the interpretation of the dream, even though he didn't convert. Nebuchadnezzar didn't convert. He's still a polytheist, and he won't convert in this chapter either. But he was impressed. He was so impressed he was going to honor God. But then as time went by, perhaps he forgot. But these three men didn't forget, and neither did Daniel. The mark, by the way, of a person, just a sidelight, but the mark of a person who knows God is that they do not forget. They don't forget. If you know God, you know you know God. If you're in covenant with Jesus Christ, you know you're in covenant with Jesus Christ, and even if you're running from him, you know, and he knows, and he knows that you know, and you know that he knows that you know, and it's just other people you're not telling. A real, genuine covenant person knows, and they do not forget. Well, these men did not forget. Nebuchadnezzar forgot, either in a short period of time or in a long period of time, but he forgot how great God is. Also remember that when a king in those days defeated a city, as Nebuchadnezzar eventually defeated Jerusalem, the feeling was that their God was more powerful than the God of the city. And I think it's very interesting that in this particular account, what you'll find is that Nebuchadnezzar, if he had those kind of feelings, got rid of them. He realized, well, whatever I did to Jerusalem, the God of Jerusalem, who's the God of these Jewish guys, is more powerful than any God I serve. And that's what he needs to learn in the thing. So watch for these things as they transpire. We're not exactly sure when this thing took place, but watch for the lessons that are learned in it, both the integrity of the three young men, but also the awareness that Nebuchadnezzar comes to. What happens is that he builds a huge statue of some sort. He calls everybody to worship it. These three men refuse to worship it, and we'll see how they refuse. He tries to kill them by throwing them in a furnace. They don't die. He has a complete change of heart about their condition and decides that God is God after all. In a nutshell, that's the story. But let's see how it develops. There are some interesting things as we go along. I want you to forget you've ever known the story. I want you to forget all the flannel graphs. I want you to forget all the movies. I want you to forget all the cartoons. And live it as you read it, as if it were the first time. Daniel 3, verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. The height was 60 cubits. That's between 90 and 100 feet, because the Babylonian cubit was 2 inches longer than the Jewish cubit, and that would make it about 20 inches long, so you can do the math, but that's between 90 and 100 feet tall. That's like a 9 to 10-story building. Do we have any 9 to 10-story buildings in Medford? Did anybody know? I don't think we do. Do we? Medford, yeah, I don't know. 9 to 10 stories. That is a tall thing. And it's only about 8 to 10 feet or 10 to 12 feet across at the base. Well, 9 to 12 feet, depending on how you measure it. It may have had a broader base in order to support this more narrow, because when you talk 90 feet tall and only 10 feet wide, that's a tall, skinny thing, right? It may have been just a giant pole, it doesn't say. It may have been like a totem pole or something like that, or it may have had a very broad base that went up 60 feet, and then the top one went, you know, the other 30 or something, and it was a statue of a human being. We don't know what it looked like. But we do know that it represented a god, probably the god Marduk, who was the god of Nebuchadnezzar and one of the main gods, one of the patron gods of Babylon. Some people speculate that it was a bust of Nebuchadnezzar himself, but it doesn't say that. We don't know for sure what it looked like. We just know it was this tall, and this is extremely impressive, especially standing out on the desert, in the middle of a plain out on the desert, to see something this tall, and it was gold. Not solid gold. It would have been overlaid with gold. And it would have been quite a project building. It would have taken him a long time to build the thing. He set it up on the plain of Dura, some distance, just a few miles probably from Babylon, in the province of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Now, he's going to list this group over and over again, and it's a little redundant for us to read some of these things in English. Because we don't write this way. This was a style of writing that was common in that period in which they repeated things that were important, names of people and so on. And it seems redundant to us. We would have shortened it. But this is the style of their writing. And he repeats this in order to show that anybody who was anybody was at this thing. The interesting thing is Daniel wasn't there, and we know Daniel was very important. This is at least several miles from Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were appointed as very serious, significant rulers in the nation, are here, and that's why they get in trouble. Where was Daniel? Because there's no mention of him in the chapter. And nobody knows for sure, but the best guess is that you'll notice in the last verse of the previous chapter, he began to work in court in Babylon. Chances are excellent. Nebuchadnezzar left him there in Babylon, several miles away, during this particular event. But everybody else who's important as a leader from all around the nation were gathered. This is a big deal. This is a national gathering of all the major leaders. And what you'll find is that the guest list included people from all different languages and all different backgrounds to worship this image. Verse 3, the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. They stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. He would have built it far enough away that they wouldn't see it under normal circumstances, because you can't exactly cover it with a blanket. So he built it out where they wouldn't be normally seeing it. Then he called everybody. Then he took them out there. And in the desert, of course, you could see it in a distance. And of course, it's bright and it's hot outside. The sun is bright and glinting off of this golden image. It would have been really amazing. People are all around it. And they're probably there by the thousands looking at this thing and amazed at it. And they don't know what they're going to do. They don't know that they're supposed to fall down and worship this thing. They just know they're going out to look at some big thing that Nebuchadnezzar built. Then the herald, verse 4, loudly proclaimed. The herald, by the way, in those days was a very important person. In ancient cultures, they used a herald to say things. The person who was the speaker didn't do the speaking. The herald did the speaking. They stood up and spoke for someone else. They were like a living public address system. So this guy's the PA. I gotta believe they had less trouble with their heralds than we do with our PA system sometimes, and maybe not as much feedback, at least not for Nebuchadnezzar. He would kill you. So the herald stands up and proclaims, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, men of every language." By the way, if you were out of earshot of the herald, they'd put another herald out there so that one would speak and then the other would speak at the same time, so that it was like speakers out in the crowd. And that was how they got the word out. So he's saying this, and the word is getting out. "It is commanded, O peoples, nations, men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe." I thought, whoa, Scotland the Brave, they're playing the bagpipe. Actually, the Aramaic terms are only roughly translated. That's why sometimes you'll find different translations for some of these terms. They refer to some sort of pipe. Bagpipe, that's what they call it, but any kind of instrument that you're blowing on there. And all kinds of music. He says, when you hear this, when you hear all of this, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. So they had a worship band. And the worship band was, they probably all knew the music they were going to play. And by the way, music is always used. It's used in the worship of the real God. It's also used in the worship of the idols. There is idolatrous music. It's interesting to listen to it. Listen for music and listen to what it glorifies. He says, this music is going to aim you toward this idol. When it happens, you're all going to fall down, and they worshiped by falling down on the ground, stretching out in front of it. And he said, that's what you're going to do. And in case you're ambivalent about this, verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the music, the men of every nation and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Well, it doesn't take much prodding if you tell people that they're going to be burned alive if they don't worship this thing. Pretty much everybody kind of thinks that through for a second or two and says, okay. What did this thing represent, though? What kind of idolatry was this? Probably it was a state idolatry of some sort. Even if it was Marduk that they were worshiping, or a bust of Nebuchadnezzar, it was the kind of religious and political connection that ancient governments made when they wanted people who had been absorbed into their empire from different loyalties to all have at least one central loyalty. In those days, they did not have a separation of church and state. All of the states were very religious, and they were all idolatrous, except Jerusalem and Israel, and they actually fell into idolatry. They all had state religions. And so what they usually did was, there was the one state religion, and then there was tolerance and pluralism for all of the various other religions. In order to make the empire big, you had to make room for all the idols that the people worshiped that you conquered. Does that make sense? So what they had was many religions available, but one that everybody had to sign off on. And by the way, this is the way the Roman Empire was, and this is why the Christians, who under normal circumstances would not have been persecuted, when they were asked to say, Kaiser Kurios, Caesar is Lord, it was the imperial cult. And in the second century especially, the latter part of the first and into the second century, the Christians were martyred simply because they would not say Kaiser Kurios. It didn't matter that they didn't like any of the other gods, but this one state religion, this one civil religion had to be, you had to sign off on it. And of course, in Babylon, these young Jewish men knew that they couldn't do it. By the way, the term Jew comes from simply the sound of the first part of the word Judah. And they acquired the name Jew after the Babylonian captivity because that's the way the Babylonians referred to them. They just took the name Judah and shortened it, and it comes into English, Jew. So it's not a bad term at all. It's simply a shortened version of the long name Judah, because all of these guys were from, all these people were from Judah. Now, as this happens, these Jewish boys are saying to themselves, or young men are saying to themselves, well, here we go. And you know something? You watch how decisive they are. You got to believe they had already made up their minds, no matter what this thing was about. If it was about what they think it might have been about, like the rumors might have been saying, they have no question. They don't even have to take a vote between the three of them what they're going to do. They've already thought it through. And you'll see, as you know the story, you'll see that decisiveness is important. By the way, have you thought through certain scenarios in your life in which you know that if push comes to shove, you're going to make a decision in which God comes first? There are several ways in which we are all tested in terms of our loyalty to the Lord, all kinds of different ways. And it's good to think them through, depending on what kind of work you do, depending on what kind of relationships you have, depending on what kind of, if God has given you a lot of money or no money, how are you going to deal with mammon? Ahead of time, deciding ahead of time, how am I going to deal with mammon, a major idol in this country? If you've got all kinds of potential in a certain area, how am I going to honor God if push comes to shove in these issues, you see? Well, these guys had thought this over. So when it came time for this to happen and the worship band struck up the music, everybody else fell down and worshiped. Well, Nebuchadnezzar assumed that this would be the case because in a polytheistic culture, worshiping another god was no big deal. The only god who is picky is the real one. So the only people this would bother would be the Jews, and Nebuchadnezzar, judging by his reaction to these young men, probably was surprised. He may have forgotten that these men follow a god that requires exclusive loyalty, and he doesn't allow multiple gods to be worshipped by these people. Everybody else would have just said, oh, sure, no problem. My God will understand. I'll worship your God for a little while, then I'll go back and worship mine and anybody else's that I want to. Pluralism really works for everybody except God. So I am convinced that Nebuchadnezzar was probably surprised that somebody would value relationship with God over success. People are still surprised by that, by the way. And they do not always respect it. They will sometimes call you a fool for valuing your relationship with God over earthly success. So all this happens. Now, there's three men who just simply don't fall down. They just keep standing there. And it doesn't say they were standing right. You know, if you see pictures of this, you see artist rendering, they're always standing right in front of the idol. It doesn't say that. Wherever they were, and there were thousands of people there, wherever they were in a place where Nebuchadnezzar didn't see them because in order for them to get in trouble, their co-workers had to turn them in for treason. The other Chaldeans are the ones who rat on them, and they come to Nebuchadnezzar, and they remind him of his own law, And he must have been wondering why they're reminding him. And then they say, now, there's three guys, and they happen to be three of your most important ones, whom he knew, as we can see that, and they didn't fall down. Which means they were someplace that was not highly visible, but they just did not fall down. Just in their own little spot, everybody else has fallen on the ground. And you look out at a sea of people lying down towards this idol, and these three people aren't doing it. These three guys aren't doing it. Nebuchadnezzar didn't see it. The other Chaldeans, the other astrologers, saw it, and they're the ones that rat. Look at what happens. Verse 8, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded. By the way, the phrase brought charges means to eat pieces of them in Aramaic. It's an idiom like so-and-so really got chewed out. In English, we know exactly what that means. Well, he really got chewed out, right? We know what that means. Well, this is an idiom that they used when you criticize somebody, you're eating pieces of them. It's an interesting way to put it. When you accuse somebody of something, you're eating pieces of them. It's just worth remembering. Verse 9. They responded and they said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. That was the way you always started your conversation with the king, apparently. You yourself, O king, have made a decree. Every man who hears the sound of the, and he lists all of the music instruments in the worship band, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. By the way, I forgot to mention that is probably the kiln that they had used to build this image. It was handy. It was right there, and they could fire it up and make it really, really hot. So that's probably why it was there. So these guys remind the king, look, you said this, right? Do you ever get suspicious when someone comes up to you and say, now, you said such and so, such and so, such and so. Is that right? And you know, man, there is something else coming here. They're going to try and manipulate me somehow with something I've said. That's exactly what's going on here. Now, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon. Now, see, they had been promoted when Daniel had come up with the right interpretation. The king said, your God is one really powerful God, Daniel. I'm going to have you be one of my main leaders. And Daniel said, I have three friends, and they all worship the same God, and they're really smart too, and they all went to the same university. Would you put them in positions of power? That's these three. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they got this position based on the fact that they worship Yahweh when Nebuchadnezzar, back when Nebuchadnezzar was impressed with Yahweh. But it bothered the Chaldeans that they worked with, the other astrologers and wise guys. It bothered them a lot. And so they never really lost it. It's a political move. They are hoping that these men get killed so that they can have their positions. You appointed them, O king, over the administration of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. Now, actually, that's not true. They had been very good leaders, had been loyal to Nebuchadnezzar, and were very willing to be loyal. They just would not fall down and worship an idol. But they were actually quite good at what they did for Nebuchadnezzar. But it's interesting, when a person is determined to destroy your character, how you can word it in such a way that it implies something that's not true. They've disregarded you, O king. They do not serve your gods. That was true. Or worship the golden image which you have set up. Now, this was said in public, and it would cause a great deal of consternation because it's embarrassing to Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't think anybody was going to do this. He really did not expect to have to throw anybody in this fire. Not that he wouldn't do it. In fact, in Jeremiah 29:22, it refers to two people that Nebuchadnezzar roasted in the fire. So we know he'll do it. But he wasn't thinking he's going to have to do it at this point in time. And certainly not to one of his, or three of his highest officials. So he's embarrassed, and this is public, and these people have stood here. They've really put Nebuchadnezzar in a spot, and actually put himself in the spot, of course, but you can see the politics happening here. Nebuchadnezzar was in a rage and anger and gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded, verse 14, and said to them, is it true? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Well, he has forgotten these are friends of Daniel's. He's forgotten these are men who are loyal to Yahweh. And he may have never known just how exclusive the Lord really is. But he says, is this true? He doesn't want to have to do this. Now, if you're ready, he says, he gives him what he does. He gives him a second chance that they don't need. If you're ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, and, you know, the whole worship band thing that I've made, then you fall down and worship the image that I made. Fine. But if you won't worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Well, he's about to find out. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered. Now, notice how quick this is. They don't have a huddle. They don't have to worry whether or not they're saying the right thing. They have practiced this little speech. They are ready for this. O Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer concerning. In other words, we don't need to think about this very much. It's a foregone conclusion. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Words of great faith. But here are the words of really great faith. Verse 18 is really the key to the whole thing. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. There's no question whether God can do something. The question is, if he decides not to, will you still trust him? That's really the question. And a lot of people have faith in God that is a sort of a papier-mâché faith. It sounds bold until something goes wrong. And then they begin to shop around for a better God. And this is a major trial. It's a major test. These men had already made up their minds. God was able. There was no question in their minds that he was able. But even if he decided not to do it and they were prepared for that, they're still not going to worship this other God. You know, it's an interesting thing. Save your life. It's no big deal. All you got to do is fall down here. This is no big deal. Just do it, and then I won't have to kill you. The temptation would have been great. And every other religion on earth would have said, no problem. Because Satan is very broad-minded about idolatry, he doesn't really care the type of unbelief you opt for. There are dozens of ways to not serve God. Hundreds, probably thousands of ways to declare loyalty to some other idol besides the Lord. And the enemy doesn't really care. He's very multi-purpose about this. It's God who's picky. These men understood. And they said, listen, you can kill us if you want to. And you know, that's absolutely the right thing, because if you're going to die, who are you going to talk to after you die? God. There were some Christian leaders, pastors of large churches in Romania back when the communists took over in the 50s, late 50s and early 60s in Romania. And they threatened the church significantly. And they threatened to kill the pastors, put them in prison, and they threatened to kill them. And they said, you get behind this state thing or we will kill you. And this was not about politics, just politics. They wanted these guys to tell their people to not be loyal to God. And they said, we'll kill you. And one of the spokesmen for these Romanian pastors said, if you kill us, we go to glory. Are you threatening us with glory? That was his answer. Are you threatening us with glory? And it actually acquired a significant amount of freedom. That stand changed the position for several years in that country. Interesting question. No matter what you do, I'm still not going to become an idolater. So do what you got to do. Well, and he does. They reject the idolatry, And Nebuchadnezzar does what he's got to do. He throws him in the fire. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered. That's a kind of a wooden way to put it. It means that he changed his whole attitude about these three guys. He was kind of compassionate, hoping they'd go along with him. And then when they said, you know, we're not going to do this. You need to know right off the bat, we're never going to do this. And he became very angry. Interesting, too, just a sidelight. But, you know, the world is actually fairly patient with you till they find out you're really never going to go along with it. It's nice to think everybody's going to be, you know, just be nice and don't talk about it. Then you get into a discussion, you find out I'm never going along with this, ever, under any circumstances, no matter what it costs me. And furthermore, by doing this and saying this, what I'm really saying is you're wrong. What I'm really saying is you're an idolater. And that's what's really insulting to the world. And the world says, at that point, the facial expression changes. At that point, it's no longer tolerance and diversity. And isn't it happy that we all live together? At that point, it's, hey, the rest of us are okay. It's you Christians that are the problem. It's you people who are so picky and you keep saying there's only one God. And the implication is that we aren't walking with that God, and that makes us very, very angry. And all of a sudden, really nice people under other circumstances are not nice anymore. They're very angry. It's the way of it, I suppose. He said, heat the thing 7 times more than normal. What that means is heat it to the max, crank it up. These things, these furnaces that they used, these kilns that they used, not for burning people. This was probably a kiln that was there to build this statue. And they could be heated. They were like if you took a milk bottle, the old-fashioned kind of milk bottles with the big, anybody remember those? The old-fashioned milk bottle with the big neck at the top, you know, the big mouth. And if you were to put that underground, that was the shape of the body of this kiln. And you could throw things in the top, and you could feed the fire from the side. So you could look in from the side where they would throw the fuel in and get it really hot. Then the heat was going out the top, and they would smelt the whatever metal they were working on up there. Now what is going to happen is Nebuchadnezzar's looking in from the side probably where they feed the fuel in and make it hot. And the men are going to take the three believers and toss them in the top. The heat that could be generated in one of these kilns was up to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that's why if you get close to something that has a large opening that's cranking out heat that's that hot, you can see why. And it wouldn't have been a nice, clean opening either, probably. It would have had kind of a jagged edge to it. They built it into a hill, into a hillside. And so you come up on the edge, and it was kind of jagged, and the heat would just be blasting. That's why the men who threw him in actually fainted of heat stroke, probably, and died, because no one could go and get him. Well, that's what happens here. He commanded certain valiant warriors, it means strong warriors, who were in his army, to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, cast them into this furnace. And the men were tied up in their clothing, right there, just what they were wearing. They tied them up in their clothes, and they were cast into the midst of the fire. Verse 22, for this reason, because the king's command was so urgent and the fire had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because, of course, they were tied up. They had to be carried, usually by, well, if you're a big guy, you can carry another big guy over your shoulder. But it might have been two per victim. And when they got close enough, they could just barely get there far enough to the edge where they could actually push these guys into Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into this fire, where they would fall down in. And the Aramaic term that's used for fall means down into, which is why we pretty much know that they were put in the top part of this kiln. Well, they got close to the thing, and they died right there. But the three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down into the midst of the furnace, still tied up. It would have been a really dramatic scene to see this. And Nebuchadnezzar would have realized, man, this is costing me a lot. It's costing me more than the men I want to kill. It's costing me some of my key warriors, too. But he had to do it, and it was a violent world, so there you go. But as he's looking, he looks inside, and he expects to see three men writhing in pain for a few seconds before they died. And he expects to see their charred bodies on fire in there. And everybody's looking, you know, because it's a gory, horrible scene. And he looks in, and they're not dead. They're walking around in there. Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded. He stood up in haste and responded and said to his high officials, "Didn't we put three men into that fire?" And they answered and said, "Yes." And he answered and said, "Look, I see four men. They're loosed. They're walking around in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth one is like a son of the gods," is one translation. King James, Old King James renders this the son of God. The reason it renders it that way is because the Aramaic phrase can be rendered either way. But to say the son of God is an interpolation, really. It's us looking there and saying, who could that be? And we assume it's the angel of Yahweh, who is the pre-incarnate Christ. Does everybody understand what I mean when I say that? Christ, before he took human form, really was the angel of Yahweh in the Old Testament, the one who spoke directly for God. And we assume it, and I think it's a good assumption. I think it probably was him. But the technical rendering of the phrase probably should be, he looks like a son of the gods. Even though I agree with the sentiment of the King James, I think it really is the Son of God. I really think it is the pre-incarnate Christ. Nevertheless, what Nebuchadnezzar, he's not making a Christological statement here. He's not talking about Jesus. He just looks in there and he sees this impressive person. Now, how impressive would a person have to be to show up as looking impressive in the midst of a fire that was burning at 1,800 degrees? Impressive. I mean, that's like when it says that the brightness of God is brighter than the sun. How impressive is that? To look into this thing and see this fire and see these three people, and Nebuchadnezzar was as close as he could get without his face burning. And he's looking, peering into this thing, and one of these guys, there's four in there, and one of them is amazing looking. And he does not come out. I wonder what that would have been like for the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because all it burned was the ropes that were holding them. So they're there. They're in their clothes. The Lord is going, "Hi, guys. Good to see you. I want you to walk over here. I need to let Nebuchadnezzar see you. Let's stand here and talk for a couple minutes. You did the right thing, not becoming idolaters. Aren't you glad you listened to your mom before you left Jerusalem?" Whatever they were talking about. It still would have been a scene, huh? So, he sees him in there. You're only a heartbeat away from the presence of God. At the transfiguration where Peter, James, and John saw the Lord Jesus transfigured in front of them, Peter thought it was so cool, he wanted to stay right there. That's where he wanted to live. He said, "Let's just build a little cabin. We'll stay right here." It is very cool. I got to believe Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't want to leave. But Nebuchadnezzar was suddenly realizing, you know, there's more to this than I thought. And he's enough of a polytheist to realize if you find a really big, powerful God, keep him happy. And he just threw three of his main guys in the fire. So he's thinking to himself, time to backpedal. And that's what he does. Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the furnace of blazing fire, and he responded, he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come out of there. You are servants of the Most High God." This is the phrase used of Yahweh in Daniel. Servants, or one of them. Servants of the Most High God, come here. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. They come walking out. I wonder if they turned and waved because the angel of Yahweh didn't come out. He stayed in there. And Nebuchadnezzar is very intent now, probably on making sure that he has not offended this God who can protect people in the fire. This is an important God. We mustn't offend him. And so he's going to treat these men very nicely. It's nice that it turned out this way for them. Verse 27, and the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the king's high officials gathered around and saw him and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor the smell of fire even upon them. I can't even stoke my wood stove without smelling like fire. Amazing. So they're standing there going, wow. And the guys who ratted on them are saying, oh, look at the time. We've got work to do. So, verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command. Now, he realizes what it takes to violate his own command. It's very tough stuff. Yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own. He's not converted. He calls them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. He's not converted yet. But he is impressed with people who are. It's kind of the first step. And that's one of the reasons why the Lord lets people who are converted go through some of the things he lets them go through. Because people like Nebuchadnezzar, who don't know God, realize there are people who do know God, and it makes a difference. He says, I'm impressed with these guys, and blessed be their God. He must be amazing. Therefore, I'm going to make a decree that any people, nation, tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you got to believe he's thinking, I hope he's listening. Anything, anybody, anywhere in my kingdom, which was huge, who says anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to rubbish heap. This was his answer to everything. I don't know if you've noticed, but Nebuchadnezzar, every time he got mad at anybody, did anything wrong, tear them limb from limb and reduce their home to a rubbish heap. So that's his answer. Well, at least he's saying it in a way that he's trying, in his own pagan kingly way, he's trying to honor God. And he says, there's no other God who is able to deliver in this way. And the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. Just a quick note about conversion. You can honor God verbally. You can respect the people who know God verbally. And you can encourage other people to honor God and be angry at them when they don't. And still be an idolater. Because Nebuchadnezzar is a classic example of it. In this country, many people delight in saying nice things about God. But that doesn't mean they're converted. Many people will talk about God in generic terms and will defend other people's right to worship God. And that's a good thing. There's nothing bad about defending a person's right to worship God. And they're saying the right things. Everything in here is theologically correct. He is the God of gods. There's no other God like him. He is amazing. But you can say all of that and not be converted. And we've seen it over and over with Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to see it some more. And it happens in our country all the time. Don't believe just God talk from people necessarily. I'm not saying be suspicious of people who claim to be genuine believers in Christ. I don't want us to be cynical about everybody. But we need to know the difference in our culture between American civil religion, which is essentially deism, the idea that there is a God, even the God of the Bible, but he kind of leaves us alone. And we only call on him when we need somebody to bail us out of a problem. There's a big difference between that kind of talk about God and people who say, repent and believe in Jesus Christ. Come to know the Lord personally. Give your heart to Christ. Big difference. And that's why these stories, these accounts of Daniel and Babylon are so helpful to us. They help us to make some of these distinctions and to live wisely. What an amazing account, huh? In closing, I want to mention some things about this. three things about it. Thoughts on living a faithful covenant life. And I've emphasized covenant here because he says, look, you belong to me. You owe me your loyalty. That's what he says to us. And he also gives to us his life. So let me mention three things you'll notice. First, obviously in the account, ease is not the main purpose of the faithful covenant life. Easy life is not the main purpose of it. If life is easy from time to time, praise the Lord. And it's okay to say, Lord, would you make my life a little easier? That's a perfectly legitimate prayer. It's okay to pray that. As long as you realize that's not the main purpose that he has us here for, because it's obviously not anywhere in the scriptures. In a fallen age, in this world, ease of life is not the main purpose. What is? Witness. Bearing witness of Christ. That's the main purpose. Not ease. It's representing him. That's why we're in the world and not of it. You don't have to go invent persecution. These guys didn't say, hey, you know, you ought to build a big thing so that we can say no and get thrown into a fire. You don't have to invent your own persecution. You just have to walk with God. Persecution will find you. And you don't have to go stir it up. But it's there. The goal of the Christian life, in the new covenant, the goal of being a believer is not easy life. It is a witnessing life, a life that counts, that demonstrates loyalty to God. And that's why the Lord allows the furnaces. Furnaces aren't always so bad. I know they seem horrible at the time. But notice the things that a furnace can do. It can bond believers together, brings them together when they have to face the same furnace. It can increase closeness with the Lord. It does. It can demonstrate God's reality to other people when you face the furnace together. And it can bless the people you don't even know when you face the furnace and you trust God and you live a loyal life and it costs you something. Other people are blessed. You say, well, how can that be? Well, when he legalized Judaism, do you know how many Jews were being deported to the nation of Babylon at the time that this took place, either just before it or just after it? The legalization of Judaism in this way protected all of the captives that God brought from Jerusalem for the Babylonian captivity. These laws right here. And the laws happened because of the furnace and the situation with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And that law, when Nebuchadnezzar put it into law, was the main covering and protection over the Jewish people for many years to come, on into the Persian period, where we read the story of Esther. By that time, people are wanting to persecute him again. But look at how good this works out for people who don't even know, all because somebody faced the furnace. The furnace isn't always that bad in God's plan, as bad as it looks to us. So ease is not the main purpose of the faithful covenant life. Here's the second thing. Length is not the main goal of the faithful covenant life. Length of life. What is? Faithfulness. It's not how long you live, it's how faithful you are while you live. You know, people, they're doing the thing about the tsunami. Anybody seen the news things about blaming God for the tsunami? How could God allow this to happen? And I won't go into it. Don't get me started on this, but I think it's important to point out that many, many people died in that tsunami, but we don't know the conditions of their souls, and only God does. Did this mean that those people would never have died if it hadn't been for the tsunami? See, the question is not why didn't 150,000 people die in 20 minutes? The question is why do humans die at all? There is an answer to that. The question isn't why did God allow this? A better question is why did God become one of us and experience it when he had a choice? We're asking the wrong questions. It's not how long you live, it's how well you live. You say, well, so-and-so died a premature death. Were they a Christian? Yeah. They graduated early. What is wrong with that? What is wrong with graduating early? So, it's not length of life, it's faithfulness. And finally, trouble is not the end result of this life. Reward is. Trouble is not the end result. Reward is. It's actually worth it to serve God. It really is worth it. It pays off. No matter what it costs, it pays off. In Hebrews 11:6, it says, those who come to God Must believe that he is, and he is a rewarder of those who seek him. That it, when you get there, you will be so glad for every faithful decision you ever made. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Ease is not the main goal or the main purpose. Length of life is not the main goal, and trouble is not the end result. It is worth it to serve God. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for reminding us of these things. We pray for each other. Even though we may not know all the challenges to the lives of the people sitting around us tonight, we pray that you will teach us how to live loyally in the challenges you bring into our lives that are designed purposely. It might not be a physical furnace, but there's some challenge to our loyalty to you that is set before us. And Father, we ask that we would respond with the kind of security, the kind of decisiveness, the kind of faith that that these three men had, and learn the lesson that your people have learned countless times through the centuries. We trust you for these things, Father, and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.